Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com.
As we talk about potential tariffs and trade skirmishes, it's important to take a look at the industries that are being affected. And joining us now has pretty intimate look at this with respect to the apparel and footwear industries. Rick Helfenbein, he joins us now. He's president and chief executive of the American Apparel and Footwear Association. And he joins us here in our 1130 studios. And just to give people a sense of what the AAFA is, it is sort of the voice of the industry that includes everyone from Levi to Ralph Lauren and Gap to Target in Washington,
D.C. If you're wearing clothes or shoes.
Right. This is the person who is representing your clothes in Washington. Rick, so I want to start with, you know, what you're hearing from your members with respect to the tariff talk and the trade tensions. Have any of their businesses already been affected?
All of our businesses have been affected. And our members are talking to us, I have to say, more than they've ever talked to us before. A lot of it is trying to figure out exactly what's going on in Washington, what's the policy, what do they want to do, what is Washington trying to do to their business. They're having enough trouble just running their own businesses. Do they really want to have added burdens? Do they want to change their global supply chains?
Hold on a sec. This is important. I mean, how much has the trade tension actually reduced from their bottom line so far?
I think that the reduction in bottom line is fast forward. It's coming. People are aware of it. Prices will go up. Sales will go down. Margins will be more difficult to attain. We don't understand why the administration is pushing so hard to take a business that is, it's still in recovery mode for a whole host of reasons, and trying to add burden to it. They're not really helping us.
Rick, I just want to give you the opportunity to share a little bit of your background, because this speaks to your experience at USA Textile Mills, also working for an overseas Hong Kong manufacturer of apparel. Just give people a little bit of your background so they understand that you're coming to this not from a political point of view, but you're coming to this from a real business perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up in the textile industry. My father was in the textile industry. I worked for a wonderful company out of Cleveland, Ohio, called Campus Sweater and Sportswear, which was owned by Interco. They taught me everything. I was down in the mills. I was in dyeing, finishing, weaving. You name it, I was involved in it from the ground floor. Later, we also had 19 U.S. Manufacturing facilities, so I know how to manufacture product in the U.S. However, later on, the industry morphed, and more of it went overseas. It happened pretty much in the 90s, so I got involved with a company who was based in Hong Kong. We manufactured overseas, and I got to see all aspects of the industry, which now, as it relates to trade, I personally feel the pain. I understand what our members are going through, and it is hurtful. We, believe it or not, in our industry, we are 6% of all imports. Keep in mind, 98% of all footwear, 97% of all apparel is imported. So we're 6% of all the U.S.'s imports, but we pay 51% of all the duties collected. Consequently, any additional burden to that, we've learned to live with that burden, but any additional burden is downright painful.
Well, just to play devil's advocate here, I mean, you talk about the shift in the 90s where the manufacturing went overseas. I mean, President Trump is kind of responding to that, perhaps, you know, a decade or so too late. But I'm wondering, you know, what would happen if those jobs did come back to the U.S. and manufacturing did return?
Well, we always ask the question, because we also represent all the domestic manufacturers, which is, quite frankly, about 3% of the market, and growing, but still only 3% of the market. Look, when you're making apparel, there are two aspects of it. One is the raw material, fabric. raw material is capital intensive, it's not labor intensive. Assembling a garment is labor intensive, takes a lot of people, and that's why a lot of this has morphed overseas. We can't really get enough people to assemble garments, and we can't compete on a global scale, which is what America is about now, trading and competing on a global scale.
One thing I'm wondering, you know, you speak to a lot of people in Washington, D.C. Is there unanimity in anything that you hear when you talk to congressmen?
Yeah, there's unanimity because people are really questioning why, in a sense, we're misusing these tariffs that you hear about. They're misdirected. They are directives of the White House. They are powers that the White House can use without consulting Congress. And Congress, by the Constitution, is in charge of trade. I'm starting to think that maybe the FDA should get involved because the White House, think about this, the White House is recommending medicine in the form of tariffs for a disease that it can't cure. Think about that. These tariffs won't cure our problems. They're wrong, and they've been proven wrong before. The whole history of tariffs is very interesting. First time we heard about them, 1930, Smoot-Hawley precipitated the Great Depression. President Bush tried it in 2002 on steel with a 30% tariff. Remember that one? Lasted 1 year. It was supposed to be 3 years. And then President Obama tried it with tires, 35%. It was a disaster, absolute disaster. Tariffs don't work. They're a hidden tax on the American consumer.
Thank you very much for being with us. Rick Helfenbein is the president and the chief executive of the American Apparel and Footwear Association, talking about tariffs, and we look forward to having you on the program in the future. Much appreciated. Warren Buffett, the chief executive of Berkshire Hathaway, and Jamie Dimon, the chief executive of JP Morgan Chase, are looking for some radical changes to the way public companies disclose financial information. They have said that quarterly financial guidance encourages short-term thinking and that it stifles growth and limits innovation in the economy. Here to tell us more about this proposed change is Andrew Stoltman, securities fraud attorney at Stoltman Law Offices. Andrew, thank you for being with us. What's your first reaction to these comments by both the Jamie Dimon and Warren Buffett?
Maybe I'm a little biased, but to me, it kind of sounds like the worst idea since the Kardashian credit card. I mean, it's just a bad idea. It's kind of an existential question. I mean, what information are investors entitled to? And under the federal securities laws, they are all predicated on full and complete disclosure. And if we go from releasing this information four times a year to maybe only two times or even one time a year, I just don't see how that's good for investors, and especially the retail investors, because large investors will still be able to get access to this information, but smaller investors won't. So I just think it's a priority issue. Are we placing corporate interest ahead of the interests of small investors?
Well, Andrew, just to push back a little bit, I mean, the argument here is that the sort of short-termism or the concept that the chief executives of these companies have to play to their just most immediate quarter and giving the best guidance possible, that they don't take some of the extra money that they have, invest it back in their business, build more plants, take more risks. I mean, not only that, but you could argue, and this is something else that Warren Buffett and Jamie Dimon were arguing, which is that this requirement to continually forecast earnings is one reason why there are many fewer companies that have gone public, which also isn't necessarily in the best interest of retail investors. How do you respond to those issues?
Well, I think that's on companies. I mean, if companies are spending an inordinate amount of time making certain that quarterly earnings are met instead of a year or 2 years or 5 years out, that's on them. I mean, there's no obligation to basically meet those quarterly numbers. And yes, you can argue that volatility will be increased to the extent companies have to release this information quarterly, but there are plenty of companies out there, including Warren Buffett, that basically remind investors, don't look at our quarterly information. We are on a year-to-year or 5 or 10 year track, and I feel like the pressure is self-inflicted on CEOs to meet those quarterly numbers. I don't get it.
Well, you know, Andrew, I wanted to follow up with the last point that I was making, which is that many fewer companies have been going public. And in part, it is because of these requirements to continually forecast data. And people are arguing that this is also really bad for retail investors because they have a smaller pool of companies to invest in. What do you say to that?
I think there are a whole bunch of reasons why there are less companies listed. I don't think the pressure of releasing quarterly earnings or quarterly revenue or that guidance is the sort of thing that would cause companies to say, you know what, we're going to remain private. We're not going to go public. I don't buy it. And look, if companies are that concerned about having to release information that I've argued they have a fiduciary duty to release and provide guidance on, maybe they shouldn't be public companies.
All right. I'm just wondering if we could just tease apart this idea that releasing information that is pertinent to public shareholders is one thing, but then that 3-month, 90-day cycle of having to meet estimates that are put together based on the limited information that you are legally allowed to offer the analyst community. Do you not see that there's a difference?
No. I mean,
okay. So let me ask you then. Have you worked for a public or a public company?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So if someone came to you and said, working for a publicly traded company is very different than working for a privately held company, would you accept that?
Well, yes, I would accept that it is radically different. But once you take public money, you have fiduciary duties to those investors.
But
it doesn't seem like people do, because people are taking the position that, gee, it's such a pain for us to release information to these shareholders who have placed their money with our company, and we owe fiduciary duties to those investors. And if it's burdensome, if it's too difficult, then they probably shouldn't be publicly traded companies. I guess I'd ask you this question. In September of 2008, do you want to know whether Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley's revenues are dramatically declining or increasing or staying or basically staying neutral? Right. I mean, that's important information for you to decide whether you want to keep your money or invest your money in these companies.
Yeah. And Andrew, I'm wondering, one thing that struck me in some of the stories that were written about this, many noted that the number of companies that actually do give forecasts, earnings per share forecasts, has fallen over the past 8 years to less than a third from about 36% in 2010. Have you seen the companies that release less guidance get treated better than the other companies or worse by investors?
Boy, Lisa, that's a really hard question, and I don't know the answer to it, and I'm afraid to kind of go out on a limb and give an opinion on that, but I'm just not comfortable going out on that branch because I haven't studied that quite as intensely as I would need to in order to make an opinion on it.
Okay, just to go back to this idea of quarterly information, the idea not being that they would decrease the amount of information that they would offer the shareholding public, but this idea of offering guidance, and then that guidance, as you well know, gets used by Wall Street analysts in order to estimate what will or won't happen. And I'm sure you're well aware of what happens on those earnings days when the company meets estimates, when it doesn't meet estimates. Do you believe that increased volatility is good for their business?
Well, I guess I'd flip it and say the opposite of that is, what if you're only disclosing numbers twice a year or even once a year?
No, disclose them every quarter.
Great. Great. Disclose. Yeah, right. And that's what we're arguing, that these numbers should have to be disclosed every single quarter. And the fact that Jamie Dimon and Warren Buffett don't want to do it isn't a valid reason when you're weighing the impact that would have, especially on small retail investors. Look, I personally think it's kind of ironic that Warren Buffett is advocating for this position, given he's the biggest shareholder in Wells Fargo. And if I'm contemplating investing or staying invested in Wells Fargo, I want want to know, what sort of impact have all of these scandals had on earnings and revenues for the company? And if I'm not getting that in a timely fashion 4 times a year, I think that kind of creates a vacuum of information. Now, look,
Andrew, unfortunately, we have to leave it there, but thank you so much. A really good discussion and hashing out a lot of the issues. Andrew Stoltman is securities fraud attorney at Stoltman Law Offices.
The credibility of central banks in emerging markets, is it on the line? Well, here to tell us more is Damian Sassauer, Bloomberg Intelligence's fixed income strategist. All right, Damian, emerging markets, there's a currency issue, Turkey, Argentina, Brazil, need I go on? Is there going to be a moment where the central banks of countries such as those realize that they're pushing against the string?
Yeah, no, I mean, we are in the midst of a crisis of confidence here, Pim. And so what what we were just talking about, what's interesting is inflation is actually stable or declining in most emerging markets. Yet, you know, markets are rushing to price in considerable rate hikes in each of these markets, you know, over the next 3 months. You know, we have a lot of central bank meetings coming on the heels of the Fed next week, and Brazil, Mexico, the Philippines. I mean, most of these markets are now pricing in additional tightening. Just, you know, it's pretty unbelievable just how quickly things have changed in only the last month.
Well, first of all, I mean, it's hard to sort of speak about emerging markets as a monolith because there is some spots where there is considerable inflation. I mean, Turkey, for example, being a poster child for that.
Sure.
But I have to wonder whether this is all a byproduct of the Fed's tightening and the fact that you're not seeing the acceleration in stimulus from the ECB and the BOJ that you had in the past. You're still seeing stimulus, just not the acceleration. So they can't offset the fact that the Fed has started to shrink its balance sheet and that it is raising rates.
Well, it's a relative value game, right? I mean, you carry so well in the short end of the U.S. Treasury curve now. I mean, money markets, right? I mean, it's an asset class all of a sudden all over again, right? That's what everybody's talking about. And so EM has to compete with that. And, you know, there are easier ways, I guess, to make money than investing in emerging markets with all of the currency volatility, to your point, Pim, that's going on right now.
Now, it used to be that if you had an emerging, let's say you were a country that was export-driven, maybe commodity export-driven, right?
Sure.
It was perfectly fine for you to have your currency devalue against the U.S. dollar because that made you much more competitive, cheaper exports, you take over markets, but now you've got trade barriers going up around the world.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, we were just talking about that the other day. So, you know, what's interesting is most people, you know, ascribe all the pain to China, right? That China is basically, you know, Chinese imports, right? Or, you know, the trade deficit the U.S. has with China and how that kind of filters through into Mexico and a lot of their, you know, the U.S.'s other trade partners, et cetera. But what's really interesting here is with these trade barriers coming up and even, you know, President Trump's kind of closet proposal to slap a 25% tax on auto imports. I mean, think about what that would do to Germany and to the CE3, Poland, Hungary, Czech. I mean, people aren't really talking about this, but, you know, I mean, those economies would, I mean, it would be devastating, right? And, you know, we were looking at basically which emerging market countries are most at risk given their bilateral trade imbalances. And the two that kind of pop up, if indeed China needs to concede to U.S. demands, are South Korea and Brazil, right? Brazil is a huge exporter of soy and soybeans and all that kind of stuff, yet the U.S. is the leading producer of that globally. So where do you think, you know, the $25 billion, you know, that China's proposing to kind of give to the U.S. is going to come from, right? And South Korea, it's semiconductor chips. So you can definitely see China may begin to kind of substitute away from, you know, from dealing with those two countries and maybe, you know, spend a little bit more money in terms of importing from the U.S. in those two areas.
Are we seeing contagion?
I mean, contagion's a dirty word, but yes, this is exactly what we're seeing right now. I mean, we're seeing things spread, and I think it's more a fact of the liquid currencies, you know, the rand now and the Mexican peso, which are basically being used as a hedge for a lot of macro players here to kind of offset their emerging market currency risk. So yeah, I mean, what you're seeing is contagion only because people are in search of a liquid hedge through which to kind of to play what's going on now in EM.
The reason why I ask is because you're not seeing massive flows out of the broad-based indexed emerging markets debt funds. So if this is contagion, I just am wondering, you know, also when you talk to people, they say these are idiosyncratic stories and they point to problems in the underlying economies. But, you know, is there a degree to which you could always find issues and sort of attribute the moves to them? But really what we're seeing is just macro plays that are playing out.
Well, yeah, I mean, okay, so contagion is... I mean, there are two ways of defining it, right? There's, you know, financial market contagion, which is what we're seeing here, which is, you know, merely, you know, price action, right? You're not really seeing it affect the real economies yet, to your point. You know, you're not seeing, you know, real economies, real growth declining, you know, real inflation picking up in a lot of these economies. But I think you're definitely seeing financial market contagion. And that is a function of the fact that, hey, people are rushing to protect their interests in a lot of these markets. And there just aren't a lot of liquid mechanisms out there to do it. So people are kind of going to the Rand, they're going to the Real, they're going to, you know, they're going to the Lira, for example. I mean, just to basically try and, you know, offset some of the weakness. And so that, from that perspective, that's the type of contagion that we're seeing.
Do we need to also go visit places like Miami? I mean, talk about capital moving. Just look at home prices.
Yeah.
Look at where the money comes from.
Yeah. No, I mean, what we look at, I guess, in EM is remittances and repatriation of assets. And a lot of that data, unfortunately, isn't real time. It's hard to kind of get your arms around it. But there are a lot of U.S., let's call it, you know, U.S. vested interests in emerging markets that are based in places like Florida. And so, yeah, no, to your point, you know, you see a lot of Latin American kind of expats, you know, who are who might very well be looking at putting money to work there, hopefully in the not too distant future.
Damian Sassauer, thank you so much for being with us. It's always enlightening to speak with you. Damian Sassauer is a fixed income strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence, focusing on emerging markets. He's great. Follow his research reports. They're insightful and deep. You know, Pim, a constant theme is, as we watch these headlines roll out about some of the trade tensions, how much should investors care? And I think it's an important question, and I'm glad that we have Eric Wiegand here with us to answer it. Eric Wiegand is Senior Portfolio Manager at U.S. Bank Private Wealth Management, overseeing about $154 billion. He joins us here in our 1130 studios. Eric, you talk with a lot of wealthy individuals, business owners. What's the main question they ask you, and what do you tell them?
You know, it particularly regarding the, you know, the trade issues, those individuals that are business owners are genuinely sensitive about the, you know, the notion that trade is not currently fair. They may be troubled and have a lot of anxiety about how you know, the discussion continues to, you know, evolve, particularly regarding, you know, isolating what have been our major trading partners and being somewhat antagonistic to our allies. But I think there's almost a complacency in some of their concerns that this is merely a negotiating tactic, that the rhetoric, you know, doesn't necessarily represent reality. They're waiting for greater clarity to really formalize their opinions.
Eric, what role does inflation play in the conversation right now with clients about what to do with their money?
You know, that is certainly one of the key focal points for us, as it has been for everyone. Everyone's looking for the, you know, the emergence of inflation. We've continued to see a very favorable labor backdrop. Wages, while we did see wages last Friday increase, perhaps a little bit ahead of expectations, you know, the persistence of inflation just hasn't been present. You know, we'd get a little bit of growth and then we'd see a little bit of retreat. Even, you know, looking at the data points that we've had this week, whether it's Delta Airlines coming out talking about pricing pressures because of the fuel increase, even, you know, it was reported today that, Smucker's was having difficulty seeing significant increase in their logistics and transportation costs. We're seeing some feed through. It's just the persistence that's necessary. To your point, Pim, one of the things that they're you know, that they're finally, you know, embracing, if you will, is, you know, that there's an alternative as a result of, you know, more normalization on monetary policy, that front end of the yield curve is finally providing a return at a lower risk point. And that's giving them a little bit of comfort at moderating some of their positioning.
So I want to bring in the emerging market sell-off that we've been watching, and I'm wondering how you're viewing that and whether you're advising any of your clients to either withdraw from some of these developing nations or to take advantage of the sell-off to capture extra yield.
You know, it's a great question. We had spent the last 2 years at much more of a with a risk-on posture across our asset allocation models for our clients. And then early this in the first quarter of this year, we thought the narrative was changing. So we began to moderate that position, taking off some of that really long equity exposure, which was inclusive of international. And while we still saw a favorable backdrop domestically, the international was a little bit more problematic.
What were you buying instead?
You know, in a couple of different areas. Number one, as I mentioned earlier, finding some attractiveness on the front end of the curve. So going from being more materially underweight fixed income to narrowing, you know, that underweight, but also looking at things that were, you know, less correlated, you know, with equities. So exploring even things like insurance-linked securities that don't have those same types of correlations.
You mentioned sort of change in short-term money rates. Mm-hmm. Are you finding that more people are interested in that than they are in stocks?
Not so much as yet. And I think part of that is because we've, you know, for all the, you know, the focus on volatility that we've seen, you know, in the equity market on a year-to-date basis, we've still moved laterally. So, you know, for the most part, our clients are still seeing, you know, appreciation in their portfolio, so it hasn't had that type of bite. They do understand, as you know, we've been very proactive at discussing with them, that our expectations for returns this year are much more moderate than what we had seen over, you know, certainly 2017.
Can you help me understand why you think the narrative is changing? Why you expect to see more moderate returns if after we just saw earnings, they were really good?
Yeah, it's absolutely a great point. And there's two things that I really want to talk about there. Number one, from a narrative standpoint, you know, we really had the best of worlds last year. Very low inflation, very accommodative monetary policy. You had strong, not only earnings growth, but strong revenue growth. You had that in an environment where there was just language or rhetoric around trade. You weren't seeing any repercussions there. And importantly, there was synchronized global growth. We've seen, you know, some of the economic data more recently has shown some moderation to that growth. It's not necessarily as strong or as broad. So that's causing us, you know, to increase our concern. We are, you know, from a monetary accommodation standpoint, we're seeing that being, you know, withdrawn or the prospect of it emerging. So we think that's changed. And, you know, importantly, as we look at those earnings growth, you know, I think the quintessential example of this was Caterpillar's earnings. You know, the stock was up during the conference call, and in the course of one sentence, you know, suggesting it's hard to imagine things getting any better, you know, the stock, you know, immediately reversed, you know, its pricing. So we agree, you know, looking at the first quarter being, you know, seeing revenue growth over 8%, seeing earnings growth, you know, approaching 24%. That's fantastic. But the market is a forward indicator. And looking at that, it is difficult to imagine that pace is likely to be sustained. So we do believe that earnings will drive stock prices. But we also believe because of that changing narrative, we'll see the valuations or the multiples that investors are willing to provide, you know, narrowing.
Just briefly, muni bonds, any interest on behalf of the clients in investing in muni bonds now?
Very much so, particularly from a, from a geographic, perspective. A lot of our clients live in some very high tax states. So whether that be New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Illinois, or California, these are areas where high income earners, particularly with the reduction in the ability, reduction in the ability to deduct state and local taxes, has made that clearly an interesting opportunity.
Thanks very much for being with us. Interesting topics. Eric Wiegand is the Senior Portfolio Manager for U.S. Bank Private Wealth Management, helping to manage more than $150 billion of customer assets. And
thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.